This is Radio Boston's Week in Review. I'm Tiziana Deering. It's Friday before a holiday weekend and after a critical primary election. And it was a week that brought greater clarity to the choices for Massachusetts voters in November.
This campaign has always been about the young people of this country. You are our future. And thank you for believing in me because I believe in you.
Senator Ed Markey there, of course, claiming victory over his challenger, Congressman Joe Kennedy. Now, the race for the Democratic nomination for Kennedy's congressional seat, which he vacated for his Senate bid, was just called today. And the winner, Newton's Jake Auchincloss, and he'll join us later in the show. But apart from that open seat, the incumbents swept Massachusetts during this mail-in pandemic primary. Now, up in Kenosha, Wisconsin, the choice before voters also became more stark with clashing priorities and rhetoric on race and policing.
I can't understand what it's like to walk out the door or send my son out the door or my daughter and worry about just because they're black, they may not come back.
In some cases, you have bad cops, so we have to take care of that. In other cases, they choke. They have a quarter of a second to make a decision. And sometimes they make the wrong decision.
Here at home, the pandemic marches forward, indifferent to November and cutting a swath through our economy, our social compact on education, and our ability to spend time together face to face. We want you to join us to talk about all of it. 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And our remote panelists are with us this week. First, we have Tito Jackson, former Boston City Councilor and now CEO of Verdant Medical, a cannabis company. Councilor Jackson, welcome back to Week in Review.
Thank you so much for having me, Tiziana.
Also with us is Joe Battenfeld, political columnist at the Boston Herald and host of Battenfeld on Boston Herald Radio. Welcome back to you as well, Joe Battenfeld.
Thanks, Tiziana. Great to be here.
And again, listeners, we're going to start with the primary, so join the conversation. What do the primary outcomes tell you about November, about the state of the Democratic and Republican parties in the Commonwealth? Did you expect the incumbent sweep? And are the results in the 4th District a case for ranked choice voting or a cautionary tale against it? Call us, 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. So Joe and Tito, that is where we're going to start. The race that really the whole country watched was Kennedy Markey. What's the headline today and headed into November, Joe?
The headline is clearly that Kennedy lost. Most people around this was a national story. And because it's the first time a Kennedy has lost his home state, in Massachusetts, Robert F. Kennedy lost, I believe, in 68, but he was from New York. So this was the first time that Kennedy had lost his home state election. And it really, I think for most people across the country, it came as a shock because even though they may have gone past the Kennedy family years ago, they probably figured that people in Massachusetts still had this close connection to the Kennedy family. And this election really shattered that premise. I think it was all about, you know, Joe Kennedy and his family. If you watch the ads that came on at the very end, the super PAC ads that he had, it was all about his family. So this was really a referendum on the Kennedy family, as well as, you know, a bit on Ed Markey. I gotta give him credit for coalescing, getting a coalition of liberal groups, environmental groups, and others that really pushed him across the finish line. But there was more to this than just Ed Markey. This was definitely a visceral rejection of the Kennedy family.
Tito, do you agree?
I actually don't. And Joe hasn't invited me on his show recently, so I can easily disagree with him. So I do have to be transparent. I endorsed Joe Kennedy. I believe from a campaign perspective, the manner in which the Markey campaign operated was masterful. What you saw, and Joe, correct me if I'm wrong, Tiziana, correct me if I'm wrong, in the front end, you saw the 10, 12, 13, 14-point lead by the Joe Kennedy side. You saw Markey be able to excite young people, use the Green New Deal and his relationship with AOC, actually be able to roll over the fact that Joe Kennedy actually signed on to the Green New Deal the day it was actually put on the floor. That never caught any steam. And then also, I personally believe The Kennedy component was actually not used early enough because if I, you know, in this case, it's the thing that you can't escape. But I believe what ended up happening also is an exciting thing in the state of Massachusetts. Had they not run, you would not have seen the turnout numbers that we saw. Well over a million folks got out and voted. And even in this pandemic, you saw people exercising their right to vote because they had something on the ballot to vote for. So I rebuff, in particular, the Democrats who said that Joe Kennedy should not actually run for office, which is the most undemocratic thing that I've heard throughout this.
Yeah, and Tito, you were right. At the beginning, there were reports that he had as much of a 14-point lead when this all started. Joe, I'm going to play two sounds from Ed Markey here that reflect both your argument and Tito's. So first, here is Markey on the Kennedy family legacy.
The Kennedy family has served the Commonwealth and our nation with distinction for generations. I revere their legacy and what they have done for our state and our country. I was inspired by a call to service by President Kennedy.
And then here he is speaking to reporters just after his win.
There's an old saying in Massachusetts politics that it's great to have young people behind you, but they just don't vote in Massachusetts. Well, we put that old saw to rest.
So, you know, that sound representing both of your arguments, there were all kinds of spins from politicos and pundits, both here in the Commonwealth, and then lots of complaints I saw on social media about the takes that people who aren't from Massachusetts and don't know Massachusetts had. And I'm wondering at this point, maybe it's literally all of the above. And that's why this was such a fascinating race, because there were so many things at play here.
But what can't be denied is the AOC effect. I believe her endorsement and her energy loom large in this race. And it actually loomed so large that the distinction relative to age and / freshness was actually made moot. But I think AOC in particular, with the connectivity to young people and the environment, was a really, really strong force. But in addition, the manner in which in this crazy time, young people were engaged online. And if you look at what happened on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, it was the type of Obama-like engagement that you saw for young people.
It still blows my mind that Ed Markey is the candidate of the young person. You know, knowing him all these years, even he would probably admit that it is a shock that he got so many young people's vote. Ed Markey's sneakers are literally older than AOC is. I mean, that's how long he's been around. and it's nothing against the Kennedy campaign, but it was an impressive coalition that Markey built. And I think AOC did have a lot to do with it. I agree with that.
And for listeners that don't know that sneaker reference, Markey had, as part of what many are saying was a brilliant social media campaign, one of his ads featured him in a pair of sneakers walking around his hometown. Yeah. Tito, go ahead.
Well, first off, on the sneakers, they'd be worth a lot of money because of the age. So they're throwback in a whole lot of ways. But I absolutely agree that kind of take on it, and the fact that Markey was seen in that youthful manner was definitely a distinction. And he, prior to that, absolutely was not seen in that way, and also I don't believe was seen as engaging in that way. And I think their campaign is to be given kudos. I know a couple of my friends of mine, a new Latino run company called Borales Consulting, has been doing some great stuff in that space too, engaging in communities that had not been previously engaged. So it's really, really great. Kudos to John Walsh and my friends over there who did a really great job.
So let's go to the phones here. 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've got Stephanie on the line from Brookline. Stephanie, go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I have one question and one observation. The question to the panel is, there is a lot of talk about the young progressives and, you know, the young voters being the reason, you know, for Mackey's victory. But I want the panels to, you know, tell me if they actually know what the percentage of this, you know, progressive bloc, let's say voters, you know, under 35 maybe, how much of those are actually materializing, you know, in a voting booth. Okay.
So, Stephanie, I'm actually going to stop you there because I want to take that question to our panelists. So thank you. Thank you for your call. I know you had another thought to share, too, but I want to focus there because it's interesting. I don't know the breakout of turnout from Tuesday. Joe, Tito, do we know sort of the age, the demographic of the vote on Tuesday and how it went?
No, we don't. There were no exit polls done in this race, so we don't know exactly what the breakdown was of the vote. But I can tell you that there's no way that Ed Kennedy won this just on young voters alone.
Ed,
you know, to have a 10-point lead, a 10-point victory, is really, it speaks to something more than just young people getting out and voting. It speaks to the fact that people really resented Joe Kennedy getting into this race and, you know, thinking he could just swat away Ed Markey and swat him out of office just because he's a Kennedy. I think there was a lot of anger about that from day one on this race that was really underestimated.
So I want to move us on from the Kennedy race now, and a good next place to go is, of course, the seat that he left vacant in order to run against Ed Markey, which was in the 4th Congressional District. Again, for our panelists and our listeners, Jake Auchincloss is actually going to join us on the show a little bit later live just to give us a check-in now that the results have been declared there today. You know, it was a tight race. There were at 1.9 candidates on the Democratic side. The highest vote getter, Auchincloss, got 23%. Tito, is that inherently problematic, such a low percentage, or is that just part of the game?
No, that's inherently problematic relative to your ability to govern. It's going to be critical. You know, my first election, we got 87% of the vote, but we still had to work our butt off when we got in office to help everyone know that we were going to govern for them. It's in this case, you know, you have something that's so far below even a quarter of the folks in that district. It's absolutely critical that he works his butt off from day one to ensure that he solidifies and connects with people. And also, he needs to have some conversations with the folks who ran at the same time as him, because I think many of their issues, obviously, in a very tight race like this, actually got just as, in this case, it was looking like it was going to be Jesse Mermel, as well as Jake Auchincloss, in a potential recount. And so when it comes down to that type of race, it is so, so critical that he has to work his butt off to solidify the whole district, because 22% is pretty daggone low.
So, Joe, I want to bring two things up in addition to that. One, it's worth noting that many of the candidates were considered more progressive than Auchincloss, and those progressive candidates of different stripes took the other roughly 80-ish percent of the vote. But there was also a huge regional divide. One, all of the candidates came from Brookline, Newton, Wellesley, you know, wealthier communities, and the southern part of the district, which is known as more moderate and more working class, went hard for Auchincloss. Also, again, typical or problematic?
I don't think it's problematic. I think that he deserved to win. He reached out. He was able to reach out to moderate voters and working class voters where the other candidates couldn't. Jesse Mermel would have won. The fact is, she would have won this race if she had finished in maybe second or even third in some of those working class communities. But in many cases, she was lower than that. So, you know, I think people have to, it shows you, like we saw with the presidential primary, where Joe Biden came from out of nowhere to win this race, that there's still a significant chunk of voters in Massachusetts Democrats who are moderate, who don't want to see a far left candidate win.
Let's play a little bit of sound, actually. Oh, Tito, go ahead.
No, I just wanted to say the other piece is we have to note he spent twice as much money, and he had a huge super PAC. And so those communities, in particular the communities of color in the bottom of the district, were pounded by his name as well as mailings and alike. So I think that, you know, we also need to make, you know, the fact that he spent twice as much money as Jesse Mermel needs to be noted. And I give Jesse Mermel huge props for being in this conversation with someone who spent twice as much money as she did.
And let me just remind callers, call on in, 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. On the 4th District, on the sweep of mostly really incumbents across the Commonwealth, on what the results of what the primaries here in Massachusetts this week mean for the larger races in November. Again, 800-423-8255. I want to play a little bit of sound from Jesse Mermel this afternoon on YouTube.
I just conceded the race to Councillor Auchincloss and congratulated him on his victory. I wish him and his family all the best. This was a hard-fought campaign, and I'm glad that in the end we shared the common goal of making sure that every vote was counted, and both supported Secretary Galvin and the clerks as they did so in the last 2 days.
So pretty hard not to see this as a dry run on mail-in voting for November. On the one hand, seems like all the votes got counted and we got the real results. On the other hand, the election was Tuesday and it's Friday. So what is the verdict on how the Commonwealth is prepared for a large mail-in voting contingent in November, Joe?
This could be a real problem in November, I think. Like you said, it's Friday and we're just now getting the final results. It was a close race, definitely, and so that had something to do with it. But they were still counting the votes as of Thursday. They were still counting the votes 2 days later. So what's going to happen in the general election when we find if there's a close race? And, you know, there's going to be legal challenges. You know, the mail. I support mail-in voting, by the way, but it does lend itself to a lot of questions as to how we're going to count the vote and make sure that votes that come in aren't counted that shouldn't be counted, that people aren't trying to double vote, all kinds of things. You know, I think Secretary Galvin actually did a pretty good job in this election, and yet we still have this delay.
I want to go to the phones here, and then I'll turn to you, Tito, 800-423-8255. We've got Caleb on the line from Londonderry. Caleb, go ahead.
Hi there. Yeah, I'm from Londonderry, New Hampshire, and I'm really jealous that you Massachusetts voters have on your ballot question the ranked choice voting option coming up. We didn't get a chance to get it on our ballot this year, but I think the Auchincloss election shows the need for ranked choice voting in Massachusetts and elsewhere. He won with less than 25%, and a couple more votes from some of the other candidates for the second place could have given her a victory. I think it's a definite sign that we need to have ranked choice voting.
Thank you, Caleb. And so, Tito, I'm going to turn to you with two questions. One, do you agree with Caleb? And two, I haven't even thought through how that would work with a massive mail-in voting contingent. So,
Yeah, so I went to University of New Hampshire, so yes, I do agree with Caleb. I think this absolutely is one of the best cases for ranked choice voting. It shows that in this case, you know, you probably would have had a substantial win by someone like Jesse, who was in this space. So I think it really makes that case. And I to Joe's point earlier, we definitely have to make sure that we have the capacity to deal with the mail-in voting, and we also have to deal with the fact that the U.S. Postal Service is under attack by the President of the United States right now and his administration really trying to hamper voting in voting by mail. So that's another critical fact. But the thing that we need to note is that we wouldn't have had this test run had we not had a Marky Kennedy race. We wouldn't have seen these types of numbers, and you would not have seen this type of mobilization. So I give also credit to this thing that we call democracy, because people should be challenged, and maybe I'm biased, because I got challenged in every single race that I had, including in the special election that I had in the same year that I had to run again. So I believe everybody else should also be primary too.
If so I can just jump
let's
in for
pivot
one
with
second.
That. Yeah.
Sorry.
Go.
Just I
no,
went
go,
to
go.
UNH also, like Tito.
And is this a reunion?
Yeah. But I totally disagree on ranked choice voting. Listen, ranked choice voting is cumbersome. It's, I don't even quite understand it all. It's complicated. And ranked choice voting, basically when someone gets the result of an election that they don't like, they cry ranked choice voting because it came out the way they didn't want it to come out. They say, oh, we need ranked choice voting. We don't need ranked choice voting.
Well, so I think what I just heard from the two of you is a pretty good snapshot of the debate we're going to hear about that as November approaches. Before we go to break, I want to pivot a little bit because there's another party. It had primaries as well, and now the Democrat nominees are going to face Republican challengers. For example, Kevin O'Connor against Markey, Julie Hall against Auchincloss in the 4th. And I want to ask you both, but against the backdrop of having lost ground in Beacon Hill and breaking pretty remarkably with the most popular Republican governor in the country, what to make of the GOP in Massachusetts right now? I'd love to just quickly hear from both of you on this. Tito.
Joe, you know more about it than I do, brother.
There is no GOP left. There's really very little Republican Party. It keeps shrinking. But Charlie Baker is no longer a Republican, really. He's more of a Democrat than a Republican. He was endorsing Democrats in this race. He endorsed Richard Neal, which says a lot to me. I think the Republican Party, they don't have a chance in November. And unfortunately, that's the case. That's the reality.
Okay, so I'm going to take a quick... Oh, Tito, go ahead.
I absolutely agree.
So I'm going to take a quick break here. When we come back, I think we're going to have Jake Auchincloss on the line. But just quickly, I want to give one of our callers last word going into the break. So Jay from Brookline is on the line. Jay, if you can make it quick, I'm going to give you the last word before the break.
Jay, your line's
not clean enough. I am so sorry. It would have been great to have you. Maybe we can get Jay back after the break. So let's take that break here. Tito Jackson, Joe Battenfeld, please stay with us. When we return, we will continue our week in review, and we are going to turn our attention to national politics. And still with us remotely are our panelists this week, who apparently are holding a University of New Hampshire reunion while we have the show today. It's Joe Battenfeld from the Boston Herald and Tito Jackson, former Boston City Councilor. Thanks for sticking with us through the break, both of you.
Thank you.
So we are waiting for 4th Congressional District candidate Jake Auchincloss to join us. He hasn't yet. I will just take a break when he comes on. But in the meantime, I think it's time for us to pivot into some national politics because, boy, that race is getting clearer and clearer every day, too. It's President Trump and his challenger, Joe Biden, both visited Kenosha, Wisconsin this week with contrasting messages. And I think I'd like to start by just hearing those messages. This is Biden in Kenosha talking about how he felt when he saw the events in Charlottesville, Virginia, and elsewhere around the country.
I thought you could defeat hate. Hate only hides. It only hides. And when someone in authority breathes oxygen under that rock, it legitimizes those folks to come on out, come out front of the rocks.
All right. And actually, this is the joy of live radio because I was starting us down that path. But now we do have the other guests that we were waiting for with us. So Joe Battenfeld, Tito Jackson, please sit tight for a couple of minutes. We're going to step away from our week in review for just a minute to talk with Newton's Jake Auchincloss, who just was declared today the winner of the Democratic primary in the 4th District for Congress. Jake, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you for having me on.
So it's been a few days in coming. Congratulations. And how are you feeling today?
Oh, I appreciate that. I am feeling energized, and we are fully focused on November 3rd. We have a Trump Republican opponent that we intend to defeat, and even more importantly, we have to do everything we possibly can to ensure that the Biden-Harris ticket is successful and that we take down the dangerous and hateful agenda of this president.
So you just talked about a Republican opponent that you need to or want to defeat in November. You emerged as a sort of moderate in the race, and you yourself tied your campaign to Republican Governor Charlie Baker. Your win is a break in this district that kind of repeatedly reelected Joe Kennedy to the third, who arguably is known as a more progressive politician. What does that say about the congressional fourth district right now, and will it be a hard race with a Republican?
There's a narrative that's emerged over the last few months about this being a progressive versus centrist race, me versus the rest of the field. It's frankly just not an accurate narrative. I was endorsed by Progressive Newton in my third term as a city councilor because of my really forward-thinking policy positions on immigration, where I co-docketed Sanctuary City Ordinance, my positions on climate change, transportation, housing. On the issue of gun safety, I have the most progressive platform in the field, going toe-to-toe with the NRA. I am a pragmatic progressive, and I am absolutely in support of a strong relationship between me and Governor Baker on COVID relief and recovery, because that's what the Massachusetts 4th needs as we are working our way through the crisis. But make no mistake, I'm a pragmatic progressive who's going to push for real change on a transition to a clean energy economy, on going toe-to-toe with the NRA, on making sure this is a country that welcomes immigrants and refugees, and that makes sure that we have a reinvented transportation system that drives racial justice and economic equality.
If it is fair to characterize the southern part of the district as a more moderate part of the district, then if you are as progressive as the other candidates in the race, what do you think explains the split between the heaviness of your vote there and some of the parts of the district that Jesse Mermel took more handily?
Well, there were clear policy differences between me and some other candidates in the field. I don't want to obfuscate that. However, this district was looking for a candidate who could be a full district representative. When the Boston Globe endorsed me, one of the reasons they cited was that in a time of crisis, I was able to represent both the haves and have-nots. And I think what many voters and what a lot of local elected officials in southeastern Massachusetts saw in me is someone who is focused on kitchen table issues. Infrastructure, jobs, economic development. How are we going to make sure that when we have this economic recovery from COVID, it's an inclusive one that guarantees a living wage and a dignified retirement? I really spent a lot of time on the ground talking about issues that affect people's daily lives, trying to answer the question, why are their lives better if I'm elected?
So now we're moving towards a general election. Jesse Mermel, a former Brookline select woman, we just talked about her, conceded and congratulated your campaign earlier today, but she did raise concerns about the process and what it means for November. Here she is.
But the fact that votes cast over a one-month period were still being counted at almost 2 o'clock this morning, nearly 54 hours after the polls closed, indicates that we have some work to do to make sure that our democracy operates smoothly. And we've better get at that quickly, because November will be here before we know it.
So now you're in a general race, and the country is going to the polls in November, mailing in ballots like never before, and in a very challenging time for the country. Do you share her concerns about voting and tallying votes in November?
I have confidence in Secretary Galvin and in the town clerks throughout this district and others in Massachusetts to competently and faithfully perform the duties of their office and ensure that all votes are counted. And I was very clear over the last 72 hours that every ballot lawfully cast before 8 p.m. on Tuesday should be counted, and I am confident that they all were. And right now, I think as a country, as a Democratic Party, we need to absolutely assert the integrity of vote by mail, because we know that it works. It's worked here in Massachusetts, as Attorney General Maura Healey said. We've seen it work in other states that have pioneered it, like Oregon. And we are facing a president whose entire campaign strategy seems to be prefaced on undermining people's faith in the very mechanics of democracy. And that is a message that Democrats must unite in opposition to.
Well, we appreciate you taking a little time for us today. That's congressional candidate Jake Auchincloss, running for office in the 4th District. I hope you'll come back and talk with us more before November.
I hope you'll have me back. It was a pleasure.
Thanks for your time today. Take care. So let's turn back to our panelists, Joe Battenfeld of the Boston Herald and former Boston City Councilor Tito Jackson. Let's just get reactions. Tito, what did you hear there?
Well, I heard the nominee speak to a couple pieces. One, his record and the policies that he was putting forward, but also two, really this piece around voting. And I think he does have a point relative to the president's attack on vote by mail. We have to make sure that we get it right. I think the state of Massachusetts has, to date, done a very good job and been very strong in that area. And in fact, Gavin has done a really great thing by never actually getting rid of the paper ballot, as many other states have done. But it is critical that we make sure that we ramp up to have that capacity to make sure that we handle what we need to handle in Massachusetts for the November election.
And Joe Battenfeld, you heard Jake Auchincloss talk about the Boston Globe endorsement, which was controversial. Afterward, they actually did a video with him pressing him on a number of things that critics accused them of not having pressed him hard enough before the endorsement. How important do you think that endorsement was in this race?
Well, I'm not sure. There was definitely a backlash against it. In fact, progressives were attacking the Globe. Progressives were attacking Auchincloss constantly throughout the campaign. And so, you know, it's interesting that he called himself a pragmatic progressive. I think that's a signal to voters that, hey, I'm actually more of a moderate, you know, by using that word pragmatic, I think is a signal. So, you know, I think he's going to be, you know, in an interesting position where progressives are going to be watching him very closely to see how he votes. And, you know, I don't think they'll ever get over that Globe endorsement.
Okay, so I want to take us to a break. I had just, we had been looking for Jay, and I think we are got him back. Actually, Jay was the caller that we were going to go out with in the A, the first segment. We have him back now. I hear his line is stronger, so I'm going to give it another shot. We've got Jay on the line from Brookline. Jay, you want to try to take us out this time?
Absolutely. Thank you for the time. So I'm looking at the national politics, and I'm looking at the top battleground states, and there used to be an 8-point differential between the top two candidates. Now it has come to about 3.7 or so. And the reason, more and more as I research, I think that the president has really taken the message off the mismanagement of his COVID response and put it on, you know, the law and order as he caveats it. And the fact that Joe Biden comes out there and does not speak about how he's going to manage this when he takes over, and the fact that he's okay to lose for principles, does not resonate. As a matter of fact,
okay, Jay, I'm going to take it back from you there. Thanks. That sets us up, Joe Battenfeld and Tito Jackson, for a conversation about national politics. Again, here is Biden in Kenosha talking about how he felt when he saw the events in Charlottesville, Virginia, and elsewhere around the country.
I thought you could defeat hate. Hate only hides. It only hides. And when someone in authority breathes oxygen under that rock, it legitimizes those folks to come on out, come out front of the rocks.
Now, Donald Trump was also in Kenosha this week, speaking to the importance of supporting law enforcement. Here he is.
We have to condemn the dangerous anti-police rhetoric. It's getting more and more. It's very unfair. You have some bad apples, we all know that, and those will be taken care of through the system, and nobody's going to be easy on them either. And you have people that choke. They're under tremendous, I said it yesterday, I said it last night, they're under tremendous pressure.
And to be clear, what the president said there was choke. I just want to make sure that sound comes out clearly. Let me turn to you first, Tito Jackson. Boy, it sure seems like the lines are pretty clear in terms of the approaches of these two candidates going into November.
Yeah, so you have Trump, who, remember, was a fan of stop and frisk and said in 2016 that stop and frisk and policies such as that should continue and we should do more there, who continues to how do you not visit the family of the individual who was shot seven times in their back? How do you go there and only stand up for police when there are people who are hurting? And it just lacks leadership. This also is a line in the sand with him calling veterans who died in World War I losers. You know, this is a president who's never sacrificed anything in his life. And he does not understand honor, commitment, or sacrifice of the men and women and the families who serve our country. And I frankly, in addition to not being fit to be president, he's unfit to be the commander-in-chief, because you can't lead people that you don't love and you don't honor and you don't respect. And so I think this and this issue in one of the battleground states is going to break the way of Biden, and you're going to see Biden be able to pull folk together while Trump does what he does best, which is push people apart and inject all kinds of doubt about what it would mean for Biden to be president when he's president right now and should be fixing all of the things that are out there, including the COVID-19.
So, Tito, you brought up two different subjects there. You talked about Kenosha, and then you talked about an article in The Atlantic last night that broke, which I do want to pick up. But before we do, I want to just pick up on the first half of that and turn to Joe Battenfeld for a second. Joe, this morning, NPR on Morning Edition had the governor of Wisconsin on, who said that actually he requested that neither candidate come to the state this week. What do you make of their visits?
Well, I think they're both trying to seize on this, and in Biden's case, prevent it from becoming an issue because, you know, the fact is that what Joe Biden was talking about was the hate and vitriolic, you know, comments made by some people and the violence. It was coming from the Antifa side. It wasn't coming from the Trump campaign side. So, you know, Joe Biden has got to distance himself from that violence. And
so,
I think
that's contested. I got to stop you there, Joe Battenfeld, yeah. Just because I think it's contested who and where the violence is coming from. And to say that it's all coming from Antifa, I believe that's contested. I think Tito wants to jump in here.
And Joe, there are folk there, the Trump supporters there, brandishing guns on a regular basis. Right. And then you and it was a 17-year-old who shot two people who came into the state for that very reason. So this component around making Antifa seem as if it has the level of organization that all of these pro-Trump groups, I think you're going a little far on that.
Well, if you're going to be defending Antifa, yeah, go ahead.
Well, I do want to clarify something for listeners. Okay, so in Wisconsin, you had the police shooting of Jacob Blake, and then Tito is talking about Kyle Rittenhouse, a 17-year-old from Illinois, who is accused of killing two people with a rifle. You also had a killing of a conservative protester in Portland, and then police going after a suspect who was a self-proclaimed Antifa member, killed that potential suspect during their pursuit of him. So just to kind of comb out the communities, the size, et cetera, to make it clear for everyone. Okay, Joe, go ahead.
My point was just that Joe Biden has got to be very careful on this issue and that he distances himself from the violence that's going on. And that's one of the reasons that he went out to Kenosha, because he doesn't want Trump to, you know, capitalize on this as a law and order issue, you know, and become the law and order candidate, because that can be a dangerous position for Joe Biden. So I think Biden coming out there was a sort of a recognition that he has to compete on this turf. And this was really, you know, tough turf for Joe Biden to be on, I think. But I think he did a good job when he went out there. And I think it was smart of him to go out there, even though the governor didn't want him to, but he had to, and now that Trump did it.
So, Tito, I want to leave time to talk about a couple of other subjects. But before we leave this one, we had you on air in the days around the protests, the big wave of protests here in Boston right after the killing of George Floyd in Minneapolis in May and early June. And you were seen as someone who helped calm a couple of critical situations during those protests. Is there calming that local leadership needs to do now, and how does that get done?
I think the one of the most calming factors is for folks to stop getting killed. When you allow these radical groups to come in with guns and shoot people, those are going to exacerbate situations rather than calming. The calming that I was able to do were with folks who were, I believe, well-meaning had many issues that were heard, but when it came down to it, they weren't walking around with guns. And so that situation is critical. And I think the piece here, I think one of the most calming factors will be a change of leadership in the United States of America in November, because what we see is a president who continues to turn his back on every single community other than the ones that actually are the ones who are being attacked and degraded across the country.
Okay, now, Joe Bettenfeld, I had said that we were going to return to the other issue that Tito brought up, which is reporting in The Atlantic in the last 24 hours using anonymous sources from inside the administration or with knowledge of inside the administration, accusing the president of being pretty profoundly disrespectful of people who were wounded or killed in battle. Here is President Trump this morning speaking to reporters at Andrews Air Force Base under the roar of an aircraft engine, refuting the claims from The Atlantic magazine.
For somebody to say the things that they say I said is a total lie, it's fake news, it's a disgrace, and frankly, it's a disgrace to your profession.
Now, we do also know, for example, Joe, that the president did express some disparagement of John McCain, for example, when he was alive, over having been caught during the Vietnam War and kept as a prisoner of war, and some disparagement of him after he passed away. So there's an example of potentially what they were talking about in The Atlantic. I want to know how important you think this moment and this discussion is to the broader race going into November.
Well, I think it's going to solidify both sides. I think the Trump people, no matter what the Atlantic says, it is an anonymous sources coming out. So it gives Trump an opening to say that it's fake news. I don't have any independent knowledge of that story, but I think it's risky to publish a story like that just based on anonymous sources. And it's going to divide both camps even further. The people obviously who oppose Trump are going to try to capitalize on it. But I think, you know, the bigger issue for Trump is that there was a recent poll that came out, I think in the Military Times, I believe, that showed support roughly split between Biden and Trump, which is not good for Trump. He should be getting that military vote. So I think, you know, as far as whether this, you know, convinces other veterans to go against Trump, it could be damaging to him. Yeah.
Tito, the words that The Atlantic says the president used were the words losers and suckers. Again, the president is disputing it, as is his administration. These were anonymous sources. If no one comes forward self-identified and confirms this, does it become just another part of this shadow boxing that seems to happen about what the president did and didn't do in his administration?
No, I think this one is going to be a real chink in his armor. I think it's going to permeate through the facade that he puts up on a daily basis. We know that he, from a fact check side, lies literally on a daily basis. But this one, and as you noted before, his ongoing feud during the time that McCain was alive, and then the disrespect that he showed him after he passed, I believe that this is going to have a very negative effect on Donald Trump. As noted, as Joe said, he absolutely needs those military families. But this also is a real question as to whether or not he has the judgment to be able to actually lead the military based on these types of comments. And by the way, I believe this is the editor of The Atlantic. Right. So I'm assuming that, and Joe, you're the one who's in this space, that editors are not that excitable in terms of writing rhetoric that can't be proven. So that's the other piece when we look at this, the validity of it coming from the editor of The Atlantic rather than just a frontline reporter.
I want to leave time for hubbubs, but Joe, Tito asked you a question there. So, you know, 20 seconds, does it matter that it was the editor?
No, I don't really think so. I think if it was, you know, it is the editor, he probably should have done a better job of getting people to go on the record on the story.
All right. Well, this was the one we will continue to follow. So many serious topics that before we run out of show, I do want to leave time for hubbubs, which are those brief local stories or events that caught our attention this week. Tito, why don't you go first?
I want to give props and give voice to the folks in Roxbury and Southend who were standing up yesterday to bring up the issue of what's happening on in the Melnia Cass Boulevard area. There were folks from both the Roxbury as well as Southend community who blocked traffic and also made signs and actually were trying to have their voice heard relative to what's happening in that area and the need for a holistic aspect to a plan as well as a reattachment of the bridge to Long Island. So I think that is notable in particular in the times that we live in.
So this was about addiction and recovery, Tito?
Yes.
Okay. Good. Thank you. And Joe Battenfeld, Tito, it's just there have been some other issues, for example, removal of trees in the Melnia Cass Boulevard area recently, et cetera, that we've covered. So I just wanted to be clear for our listeners.
Yeah. Thanks. I'm sorry, but I think this is the first time I've ever done a hubbub. I usually prepare them, but I don't get to do it. So this is I'll be better next time.
You did great. Let's turn to Joe Battenfeld because I think you've got one too, Joe.
Yeah, and Tito, you're going to like this one. Michelle Wu, Boston City Councilor, if you look at her campaign spending, she has increased her campaign spending pretty dramatically doing stuff like digital advertising buys and campaign research. So what does this indicate? It indicates to me that she could be preparing for a run for mayor. And I think it's very interesting. It's going to set up a tremendous race if Marty Walsh does indeed even run for another term. It's going to set up a tremendous race in the future coming up in 2021.
So Tito, former mayoral candidate, former Boston City Councilor, any prognosticating you want to do there?
I prognosticate that Joe was going to give anybody who runs a hard time.
All right, fair prediction, probably.
That's true.
Okay, so mine just briefly, in the things I have could never have done on my best day category, mine is that according to the Associated Press, 16-year-old Vera Rivard of Springfield, New Hampshire, 16-year-old swam the English Channel on Tuesday in what was called roly-poly waves, which I can't even get my mind around. She says she likes choppy water. I just want to be clear. She had to ensure she never got out of the water and never touched anything that floats during her more than 14-hour swim across the channel. I got to admit, I don't get it. I couldn't do it. But more power to Vera Rivard. All right, that is our show. I want to thank our panelists, Tito Jackson, former Boston City Councilor and now CEO of Verdant Medical, a cannabis company. Tito, thanks so much.
Thank you. UNH represent.
And Joe Battenfeld, political columnist at the Boston Herald and host of Battenfeld on Boston Herald Radio. Joe, thanks to you too.
Okay, thanks very much.
Loved having them both. Look forward to doing that again. And that is our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Tiziana Deering. Have a great weekend and join us again Monday for more Radio Boston.